This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Today, we bring you a special holiday episode of the show. Each day this week, we look at the key stories this year that shaped one country in the region. Today, it's Solomon Islands. The country made headlines this year after signing a security treaty with China.
We really need to start talking about Solomon Islands security threats and what's actually happening here and what the real needs are right now.
We'll also take a look at how Solomon Islands Prime Minister Manase Sogavare defended the treaty with Beijing this year.
Solomon Islands had been unfairly targeted since formalizing diplomatic relations with the People's Republic of China just over 3 years ago.
And we look at the year in sports for Solomon Islands, the thrills and the spills which took place, well, mostly on the soccer pitch. All that and more today on the show for a special look back episode of Pacific Beat. I'm Priyanka Srinivasan, so glad to have your company. As I mentioned, we're taking our time this week to unpack some of the key stories from the Pacific that made up the year. And of course, Solomon Islands' decision to sign a security deal with China in April defined geopolitics in the region for the rest of 2022. Will that be the case still in 2023? Well, for more, we're joined by Solomon Islands reporter Chris and Rita Amanu-Leong. Good morning to you, Chris and Rita.
Very good morning to you, Priyanka.
Now, Solomon Islands has been put on the international stage in a big way this year. Can you tell us how has politics and the political landscape there in Solomon Islands changed compared to this time last year?
Well, yes, Priyanka. This time last year, Solomon Islands was dealing with what government have come out to say, regrettably, a second major riot since the burning and looting in the capital that was in 2006. So based on this last year, the government have been made aware of the urgent need that's to strengthen its police force. And this was what triggered a request to the Australian government under the bilateral security. So currently here in Honiara, we have close to 1,140, I think, international assistance forces, which are made up of Australia, Fiji, and New Zealand, which they're working closely with the Royal Solomon Islands Police Force in restoring law and order in the country. And that was since last year, so that's been a year now. I believe they'll be on the ground until next year after Solomon Islands hosts the Pacific Games. That's 2 weeks. That's from November right to December.
Well, it was very interesting to have those three nations there, or the police forces there. Are they on the streets? Can you see them as you walk around Honiara?
During the festive season, yes, we can see some of them on foot, but majority, it's only the local police force who are walking on the streets. We do see some of these international assistance forces. They are mostly in their vehicles patrolling around. So around the same time when this assistance force had come in from the countries that I'd mentioned earlier, we also had assistance from China in the form of liaison officers and riot equipments as well, which were basically aimed at equipping the local police force with skill sets. So that was what happened, and that sort of carried on until March of this year, where a security agreement, like you mentioned earlier, well, it was supposed to be a confidential agreement, but it was leaked. And that also saw Solomon's and China enter into sort of a wide-ranging agreement. And that just changed everything, the political landscape. There was massive international attention on our country this year. And being Solomon Island as well, at least for my lifetime, I haven't seen that much of attention into my country. So Solomon Islands continue to receive huge attention, and there were lots of donations also by both Australia and China that's like to do with the police force, and there were vehicles, even dozens of semi-automatic rifles, and this was all towards stepping up our police force, which the international the countries from Solomon Islands thought that this is what would help our local police force. Also, there was lots of funding that had come in for Pacific Games. Our government is really, looking forward, and they're looking forward to the Pacific Games. It's something that hasn't been done in the country. So it's something that our government have strongly put lots of funding into, and with the help of donors, Australia also came in this year. So all that donations our country experienced from both Australia, China, and we also had quite a number of other countries who have also come in to support Australia. And Priyanka, I think this year itself has been a tussle between China and Australia. Like I said earlier, it's something that we haven't experienced as Solomon Islanders, or at least not in my lifetime.
Yes, yes. I mean, like I said, Solomon Islands has really been put on this international stage there. And like you said, it was triggered from these riots in November last year, where a lot of businesses were targeted there in Honiara, a lot of Chinese owned or people from Chinese background, their businesses were the ones that were targeted. This was almost exactly a year ago. What's the holiday season like this year?
This holiday season has been a different one, Priyanka. I mean, our country has suffered from the pandemic, and then we had the November riots last year. So this year, after all that, to have people go about doing their Christmas shopping, and it was like the atmosphere. Everyone was just excited. They were looking forward to Christmas, and it's something that I haven't experienced. Well, I've been here almost all Christmas, so I haven't experienced that. So to have to see Solomon Islanders in that in that atmosphere, they're all looking forward to Christmas. That was something very exciting for us for this holiday season. Like you mentioned, the November riots, it was terrifying. 3 days there was the central bank's report came out. There were 63 buildings that were burnt and close to 534 million Solomon dollars in terms of economy loss. So these holidays have been quite peaceful. Police have issued statements to ask Solomon Islanders to respect each other and enjoy the true meaning of Christmas. And I think for Solomon Islanders, they are either in church over the Christmas period, or perhaps having a motu, or like Fijians call it, the Lovo, or I think the Samoans say Umo. And others might probably use this opportunity to catch up with families over some barbecue at the beach. And yeah, so I was in Honiara doing some last minute Christmas shopping as well. And I did come across busy, shops and supermarkets and traffic. Oh, that was a disaster. And but yeah, I think I spoke to a number of people who were, buying bags of rice or cartons of Solomon tuna and noodles, and they were rushing to, get all this done before Christmas. Many I spoke to had planned to either go back to the provinces to celebrate Christmas and be back as well for the New Year. So I think for any Solomon Islander this holiday season, it would be not to expect Santa Claus and Christmas presents or treats. But I think it's to really share the little that they have earned over the year, and with all the challenges that they faced, to share a little of their earnings with their family and friends, whether it's in the form of a bag of rice or a carton of noodle, Priyanka.
Oh, well, that's lovely. I guess it's beautiful to see that Honiara is in peace, but I guess one bad aspect of that is the traffic, it sounds like, Chris and Rita. Now, the security deal with China was, as we've been talking about, the big story this year out of Solomon Islands. But how about you, Chris and Rita? Are there any smaller, perhaps overlooked stories that that caught your attention over the year?
That's right. I think when the security deal agreement came up, everyone was just focused on that story, and they sort of everybody left some of the, you know, the stories that I felt could have received more attention. And I think in particular, I felt that the 80th anniversary of the World War II that happened here in Solomons, it was an interesting one for me, where they were to know more about the history of Solomons, where more than 25,000 people were killed and also dozens of Solomon Islanders. I felt that this was an important history for Solomon Islanders to know. And when and having covered this event and talking to ordinary Solomon Islanders and to have the reactions that most of them, in fact, those that I spoke to are mostly students, and they sort of missed out on this important history. They don't really, I mean, understand, or they do know that the World War II did happen in Seoul some 8 years ago, but to know in depth of, you know, all that, and that's something that I think I felt that this was a story that, for me as a journalist, it sort of challenged me. I think I'll be doing more stories on this deadly affair, and also highlighting, I think there's a need for countries that were involved in the Battle of Guadalcanal, especially when it comes to unexploded ordinances, which continue to litter our country, you know, 80 years on, and killing ordinary Solomon Islanders who had nothing to do with the Battle of Guadalcanal, you know. I think that this was a very important story, or that, you know, history that Solomon Islanders should be able to know as well. And those that are part of this should be able to come forward and, clean up their mess as well. So I think I felt that this story could, you know, it was an important one for me this year.
Yes, very true. And how about yourself, Chris and Rita? You're a journalist there in Honiara, in Solomon Islands. Do you have any highlights from the year? I mean, it can be work-related or something more personal. And how about for the next year, for 2023? Do you have any thoughts about what the big stories might be that you're chasing in the country next year?
Oh, dear. So I think for my highlight for this year, when I think perhaps I'll just stick to work-related. I think my highlight would be having a full-time, you know, job, a full-time worker as with the ABC. I think for myself that is my highlight, to be a Solomon Islander and a female in my 20s. I think achieving this is a huge milestone for my career. So I think that would be my highlight. Well, I would say work-related, but it's more like a personal one. It's like I'm, yeah, just both, so two in one. I think looking forward to 2023, and with regards to the expectations perhaps for stories, I think Solomon Islands is now in a situation that we have the international attention, or at least from China, USA, Australia. So I think stories next year will be mostly around that. And of course, about how Solomon Islanders feel towards all this, and the stories that Solomon Islanders feel closely related to, those will be the bigger stories for me next year to work on and be able to share their stories through this platform. So I can predict, but I think predictions sometimes don't go away, so I'll just take it as it comes, Priyanka.
That's very wise, Chris and Rita. And you said your highlight was joining ABC as a full-time reporter there, and it's certainly my highlight and our highlight here at Pacific Beat as well, to have you and the other very talented journalists like Lude Mavono join our team full-time and be our reporters. It's certainly already been such an advantage to our coverage in the Pacific. And yes, I can't wait for all those stories that you'll be covering next year, Chris and Rita, when it comes to Solomon Islands and beyond. And And you are listening to Pacific Beat here on ABC Radio Australia. You've joined us for a very special holiday episode of the show where we look back at the key stories that made up the country. Well, one country each day, each week, this week. Today, we're looking at Solomon Islands. And let me now take you back to May, where the big news, not just for Solomon Islands, but the region as a whole, was China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi's visit to Honiara to meet with Prime Minister Manase Sogavare. His visit came just weeks after the two countries agreed to that controversial security pact. On the morning of that visit, Jordan Fennell spoke to Dr. Anouk Ride. She's a Solomon Islands-based researcher affiliated with the Initiative for Peacebuilding at the University of Melbourne. She began by talking about the significance of this visit to politics in the region.
Well, this week is certainly a big step up in the diplomatic relations between China and Solomon Islands. But one of the things I've been sort of talking about in the last few weeks, too, is, you know, after these announcements are done and, you know, things sort of move on with the Australian election, we really need to start talking about Solomon Island security threats and what's actually happening here and what the real needs are right now.
And what are those? What are those needs? What are the real security threats? There seems to be a geopolitical stoush over who can best help Solomon Islands deal with these security threats. But what are the realities of that?
Yeah, exactly. So we've got a number of security problems right now, or crime that's sort of happening more or less out in the open right now. And, you know, in the cities in particular, that's theft. It's illegal sales of alcohol and marijuana. It's organized prostitution, money laundering. These are all occurring, you know, on a regular basis, and the police have struggled to really be proactive and act on these. And then, of course, we have a big situation coming up potentially next year, which is the national general election. So politics has become quite fractured. You know, there's two sides. They have quite opposing positions. They rarely talk to each other. And also there's sort of political fractions between the provinces and the national government as well. So it's going to be a very controversial election, and we really need to think through what the security threats are around that election and make sure that the Solomon Islands Police Force and also any other foreign forces are responding appropriately.
With that idea of the police force, you know, in the past, as the Australian government has helped to bolster with training and to deal with things like security threats on the ground, they obviously left Solomon Islands a while ago, did come back recently because there were riots in Seoul's to do with the Prime Minister. On the ground, what is the feeling in terms of outside foreign powers helping with the police force? Do people lean a certain way, or what do they talk about when they talk about, yeah, other countries helping out to bolster the Seoul's police force?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the mood is much more different than, 2003. Like, 2003 was after the civil conflict. You know, you had men on the street with guns. Everyone was really insecure, and foreign forces were really welcomed because they had that initial show of force, and also they had a disarmament program so that they got guns out of the hands of local people, and then, you know, people could feel safe to go market and do, you know, do their everyday activities. This time there's been a lot of questions, you know, do we need foreign forces at this point? I mean, we've now, you know, the civil conflict was like 20 years ago next year. that's when it finished, yeah? So we've now had sort of foreigners having a significant presence in security for more or less 20 years. What are the real impacts of this? Why do we still have, you know, these things happening on the streets, you know, illegal alcohol sales, prostitution, money laundering? Why do we still have this need after all this time? Obviously, something's not, you know, going right there with the assistance that's being provided in terms of improving the Solomon's police from a service user perspective. So, you know, the problems that people have with who experience crime and then need to report it to the police are, you know, about the slowness of the police and the justice service, about their lack of proactiveness sometimes. So, you know, that's Solomon Islanders, they really just want an effective police force, right, that will respond to these everyday issues that they have, so that they also feel confident to report crimes. Like, one of the issues with the police force at the moment, and this was sort of shown out in several surveys, is trust by Solomon Islanders in their own police force is fairly low. We'd want it to be much higher, you know, as indicated in surveys and so forth. And to make that trust, you know, stronger and to come up, we need a proactive police force that seems to be responding to the security threats that people can see on the streets or in the villages or at the logging camps. These are the things that people want to see. They want to see progress on those kind of issues. So the police, the foreign forces that came this time, they've been much more criticized and there's been much more questions asked about them in civil society, the opposition, parliament, different forums.
You say that to fix that engagement, Australia needs to draw some red lines with Solomon Islands. What are those red lines and how should they go about doing that?
Yeah, well, I think the first red line that Australia needs to draw is around itself. So they led the Solomon Islands Assistance Force, which was the sort of foreign police and troops that came in after the riots in November 2021. But compared to previous engagements, this force is very vague. We don't really know what the metrics of success for this force are, what they're supposed to be doing, how long they'll stay, and also how they operate together. There's been sort of some confusion about who's in it and how they operate together. So I think the first thing it would be really useful for, you know, increasing people's senses of security around the presence of foreign troops is better communications about what Australia's doing here right now.
That was Dr. Anouk Ride, a Solomon Islands-based researcher, speaking there with reporter Jordan Fennell. That interview first took place, I think, back in May. And since that interview first went to air, Australia's new Foreign Minister Penny Wong also made numerous visits to Pacific countries, including to the Solomon Islands. And since that interview went to air, Solomon Islands has decided to controversially postpone its election to 2024. And just last month, China donated water cannon trucks and other vehicles to the Solomon Islands police, days after Australia made its own donation of semi-automatic rifles. Pacific Beat. You are listening to Pacific Beat. We're taking a close look at the stories that made Solomon Islands over the year as part of this special holiday episode. And indeed, we can expect that this intense scrutiny around Solomon Islands' relationship with China will continue. This year, though, Prime Minister Manase Sogavare spoke out about it. In September, he defended his controversial security pact with Beijing, saying he was vilified and targeted because of it. But as Evan Vasuka reported at the time, it wasn't just geopolitics raised by Pacific leaders at the global meetings, but climate change too.
Solomon Islands security treaty with China has been a topic of global media attention, and Prime Minister Manase Sogavare wasted no time in addressing that topic.
The right to establish diplomatic relations between sovereign nations is a universal principle shared by all members of the United Nations. Solomon Islands had been unfairly targeted since formalizing diplomatic relations with the People's Republic of China just over 3 years ago. We have been subjected to a barrage of unwarranted and misplaced criticisms, misinformation, and intimidations that threatens our democracy and sovereignty.
The pact with China raised the ire of Australia and the United States and its Western allies over fears it would give Beijing more influence in the Pacific region. Mr. Sogavare reassured world leaders that there had been no military base in Solomon Islands. He says his country has been targeted for its relations with China.
Solomon Islands has been vilified in the media since formalizing its relationship with China. This decision was reached through democratic processes by a democratically elected government. Our decision to establish relationship with the People's Republic of China is consistent with the United Nations 1971 World Resolution 2758, observed by most countries in this esteemed assembly, and which also articulates the one China policy that Solomon Islands respects. I reiterate the call for all to respect our sovereignty and democracy.
Kiribati President Ta-Nehisi Maumau also shared the same sentiments. His country had switched diplomatic ties from Taiwan to China in 2019 at the same time as the Solomons.
The escalating geostrategic competition in our part of the world means that regionalism and solidarity are at risk are being increasingly used to serve specific national interests rather than a collective of diverse needs and views working in unison for our common benefits. As is the case now, any differing views and sovereign decisions that deviates is at the risk of being vigorously scrutinized and labeled a foe through a security lens rather than a genuine desire to pursue sustainable development for the country and its people.
Geopolitics aside, climate change continued to be a key issue for Pacific leaders. With the COP27 UN climate talks to take place in Egypt in November, Fiji Prime Minister Frank Bainimarama told world leaders to only attend if they were serious about climate change.
Only come if you plan to arrive true to your climate finance commitments. Only come to Sharm el-Sheikh if you are ready to agree to a loss and damage mechanism in addition to a post-2025 financing framework. This must be in the order of $750 billion, with at least 10% of climate finance destined for small island states.
Vanuatu's plans for a UN vote to get climate change before the International Court of Justice may have been delayed to the end of the year, but President Nikenike Vorobaravu is urging members to sign up to a global treaty on fossil fuels.
We call for the development of a fossil fuel non-proliferation treaty to phase down coal, oil and gas production in line with 1.5 degrees Celsius and enable a global just transition for every worker, community and nation with fossil fuel dependence.
That was Vanuatu's President Nikiniki Vurebaruvu, ending that report by Evan Wasuka. That was on the New York UN General Assembly. The story first went to air in September. And since then, of course, Vanuatu and Fiji have a new government. And Vanuatu's draft resolution to get climate change to the International Court of Justice has been published. It's now awaiting a vote by UN members.
This New Year's Eve, join us to get the party started on the ABC with entertainment for the whole family. Kickstart your night with fun and celebrations from 7:30 PNG time, followed by the early call-in country fireworks. Then watch the best Aussie live music in a concert lineup packed with top artists. And stay up for the spectacular midnight fireworks to see the year out with a bang.
Happy New Year!
Celebrate your New Year's Eve from 7:30 PNG time on ABC Australia.
You are listening to ABC Radio Australia. This is Pacific Beat. You've joined us for a special holiday episode this Wednesday morning. We're taking a close look at the stories that made Solomon Islands over the year. And this year marked the 80th anniversary of one of the most pivotal Pacific Ocean battles of the Second World War, the bloody fight between American and Japanese forces for the island of Guadalcanal in Solomon Islands cost thousands of lives. Kyle Evans brought us this report in August on the legacy of that conflict on the people of the island.
Many decades on from the Battle of Guadalcanal, the cries of anguish on the island haven't stopped. Francis Deve hears them often. He lives on the island, and for 36 years he's helped excavate remains from the battlefields so they can be repatriated to Japan for burial. He also acts as a guide for Japanese visitors who make the pilgrimage to the Solomons to find their ancestors.
It is a deep, deep heart of condolences. Even during our ceremonies, they shout their grandfathers. They call for them, we are here, we bring you food, we bring you water, we bring ourselves, and they write letters. They give homage. They laid wreaths, and they express them that since you left us, we wait for you, and you didn't come back. So now I come on behalf of my grandmother, I am your son, and they introduce themselves like that. If you translate those messages where they were telling during during the ceremony, it is very, very tearful, and it's very, very sad in a sense that, you know, you're missing somebody you love, you know?
This week marks the 80th anniversary of the battle, which began on August 7th, 1942. Up until then, the Japanese army had marched relentlessly through the Pacific en route to Australia. But World War II historian and battlefield tour guide Matt McLaughlin says the canal is where everything changed.
It was a pretty crucial battle in the Pacific War. It was the first one that the Americans fought in, and it turned out to be their longest. So it was really the turning point in the Pacific, because up until this point, the Japanese had been advancing pretty much unchecked through Asia and the Pacific. But when they got to Guadalcanal, they met the Americans and were defeated in that battle eventually. And so that was the furthest the Japanese managed to advance in the Pacific. And every step they took from that point onwards was backwards towards Tokyo, where obviously the war ended in 1945. So a very significant battle.
A small airfield being built by the Japanese was the major prize of the battle. It had huge strategic importance and would have allowed the Japanese to cut off Australia from its allies while denying the United States military an important base in the Pacific.
It was a really fascinating Pacific battle because the Americans landed in August 1942 and managed to capture the airfield that the Japanese were constructing and flew aircraft in to operate from that airfield. So the aircraft could only operate during daylight hours. So during the day, America completely dominated the skies. But at night, the Japanese Navy would come in and could operate pretty well unhindered because they didn't have to worry about aircraft. So control of the island really seesawed between the Americans and the Japanese every 12 hours, depending on whether it was daylight or dark. So the Americans were on the island after their initial landing, and for the rest of the campaign, the Japanese continuously sent down reinforcements to try and build up forces to retake the airfield. And that led to several huge battles on the island. But ultimately, the Japanese were never successful in retaking the airfield.
The battle raged on for 6 months, and more than 20,000 servicemen lost their lives. By the time it was over, the tide of war in the Pacific had turned.
In the words of the Japanese, this was the decisive battle that would determine the rest of the war. And that was a pretty fair estimation. I think the Japanese were obviously never going to win against the Americans. But it was important that we kept defeating them on land, that we restricted the Japanese from expanding, that we gave them a bloody nose wherever we could. And Guadalcanal was the first time that occurred. And I think significantly for Australians, we tend to think of New Guinea as the battle that saved Australia. And while New Guinea was extremely important, the decisive battle that meant that the Japanese were forced to pull back and could no longer advance on New Guinea and on Australian ports was Guadalcanal. So the two battles were fought hand in hand. And as Australians, we often overlook Guadalcanal. But I think looking at the history, you'd probably say that Guadalcanal was the more significant of the two.
To this day, relics from the Guadalcanal conflict still litter the ground. 300 sunken planes and ships lie in waters off Honiara, aptly known now as Iron Bottom Sound. For those who know the terrain, evidence of the fighting on land is not hard to find. But Francis Deve says more needs to be done to guide battlefield tourists in the right direction.
This is the biggest project that I'm talking about now. And I wish if Australia, New Zealand or US and or Japan can be willing to step in, and even British, because I need Coast Watch's monuments to be built. I need a Japanese site to be built. I need Australian sites to be built. I need New Zealand sites to be built, monuments in the parts where the Solomon Islands war covers, you know. We have Australia, New Zealand having a lot of engagement here on Guadalcanal. I've been covering all these sites with my research team. And then we do a lot of information that we collect from them. And it's quite hard to identify sites at the moment. So I'm talking to the Ministry of Tourism, Culture and Tourism. We might be knocking at your doors to make sure that these monuments are built. And it will be an attraction because we realize that people are coming here. They still said, where is the battlefields? And these sites were identified, but there is no monument.
This weekend, the island will welcome more than 200 tourists to mark the battle's anniversary, including a delegation led by United States Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman and the new US Ambassador to Australia, Caroline Kennedy. Head of Sales and Marketing at Tourism Solomons, Fiona Tiama, says the event will give fresh impetus to the industry as it seeks to recover from the impact of the pandemic.
We see that tourism holds the future for this country as opposed to the extractive industries. However, there are still some challenges that we really need to work together on from the government level in terms of our infrastructure. As you know, the tourism industry in Solomon Islands are of a very small scale, eco-family-friendly-oriented base. We don't have five-star hotels or resorts. We want to keep it at that level, but there still needs to be improvement in terms of infrastructure and more development with our air access and all that sort of things that will support the industry.
Part of the event will be the official announcement of a U.S. ambassador to the Solomon Islands to head up a new American embassy. It's hoped the embassy's presence in Honiara will assist in establishing a dialogue to deliver better tourism infrastructure.
That was Kyle Evans with that report that first went to air back in August. You're listening to Pacific Beat. I'm Priyanka Srinivasan. Hope you're having a lovely Wednesday morning. Kava is relatively new to Solomon Islands, but already it's stamping its mark as a favourite cash crop. And exporters are eyeing the biggest market in the region, Australia. But as Chris and Rita Amanu-Leong reported earlier this month, meeting the market requirements means providing a high-quality product.
Yeah, okay.
Wale Tobata owns Rafali Holdings Limited and is the only Solomon Islander out of 430 suppliers in the Pacific exporting kava to Australia in a pilot project.
I'm mindful of the fact that if it's not pitched right when you put it out there, then it has the potential of destroying our market prices. And so, for me specifically, I have to trade carefully.
Drinking kava isn't part of Solomon Islands culture, but it's becoming popular and now an export business. As chair of the new kava industry working group, his focus is on the communities and stakeholders.
We can have a much more coordinated approach in terms of seeking assistance from the donor partners and development partners who are seeking to help us. But ensuring that the developments that we do, like I said, is far-reaching and reaches out to our communities and the stakeholders who are involved in this industry.
Switching from fruit and vegetables in 2016 to kava was a key decision for Shirley Money. She's now the country's only female kava exporter and is also eyeing entry into the Australian market.
I see that there will be a big growth because, like, if we send kava into Australian market, then we need to, like, it's an growth for our business, because if we meet the requirements, then I think Solomon Island will not meet the demand for Australia to export into Australia, and it will help us too in the future that we will gonna have more profits, and the prices in Australia is really good.
Australia is the key destination for kava exporters in the Pacific, and the pilot scheme is open to exporters. Alison Purnell is Australia's economic counsellor in Solomon Islands. She says there's a big potential market beyond the growing Pacific footprint.
2020 census estimated over 200,000 Pacific Islanders. For kava, we would be relying on that diaspora of Pacific Islanders who drink and use kava as part of their lives and as part of their culture. But perhaps as kava becomes more accessible, more known, more readily accepted in Australia, that this might be the potential for kava to grow beyond the small diaspora which is currently there at the moment.
And while the industry has been dominated by mostly men, Ms. Purnell says it was absolutely wonderful to have Shirley Money as a pioneer in the industry.
Australia is a firm believer in encouraging economic growth, and especially encouraging economic growth opportunities for women. So to see one woman there being a pioneer in the industry, good luck to her, and we wish her every success.
That was Australia's economic counsellor in Solomon Islands, Alison Purnell, ending that report from ABC reporter Chris and Rita Amanu-Leong that first went to air earlier this month. You're
You're listening to Pacific Beat for a very special holiday episode of the show. Each day this week, we're taking a look at one Pacific country and seeing the stories that shaped them in 2022. Today, we're looking at Solomon Islands. And we're also wrapping up the top sports stories of each of our featured nations every day this week. Naturally, for the soccer mad Solomon Islands, the game featured heavily this year, along with preparations for the upcoming Pacific Games. Nick Fogarty takes a look at how Pacific Beat saw Solomon Islands a year in sport.
After knocking off PNG in the semi-final, the Solomon's men's soccer team were full of hope at the kick-off against New Zealand on the 30th of March. The match was in Doha, the final of the Oceania World Cup qualifying tournament, and a victory would send the winner to the intercontinental playoff, within touching distance of the World Cup finals. The Benitos had recently managed a draw against the Kiwis, but on this night it wasn't to be, as New Zealand pulled away in the second half, eventually winning 5-0.
De Vries. De Jong. Andre De Jong. McGovern! A five-star performance from New Zealand.
Despite the final disappointment, it was valuable experience for the Solomons, not least the teenage star Rafael Leai.
Rafael, what a one! Wonderful play, fantastic play, straight through the defence of Tahiti. And there's Rafael, what a one with a goalkeeper. Was it in doubt? Slides it underneath him for the first goal of the evening.
Leai shone at the World Cup qualifiers, and despite trials with Wellington Phoenix and Melbourne Victory, he wasn't able to secure a professional deal in 2022. After the Doha tournament, Pacific Beat spoke to his national coach, Felipe Vega Arango.
The Spanish media asked me about Rafa, and I say that if I am a coach in a Spanish team, I will take him right away. Why? Several reasons. He's young. He's eager to learn. His work ethic is fantastic. He's extremely fast. He runs 40-meter dash in 4.2, 4.3. He's naturally gifted. With the right coaching and with the right support, I really believe Rafa could play in a top league in the world.
Meanwhile, on the harder, smaller indoor surface, the Solomons also faced New Zealand at the IFC Futsal Cup final in September. Again, New Zealand prevailed, but Solomons continued to pave the way for Pacific football nations, having made the FIFA Futsal World Cup for the fourth time the year before, still the only Pacific nation to do so. It was this achievement that attracted documentary filmmaker Jim Williams, who set out to tell the team's story. Rafael Leai again featured heavily, having injured himself and missed the whole World Cup. And Pacific Beat caught up with Jim Williams in November to talk about it.
He got injured in a friendly, like maybe 3 weeks before the World Cup. And he was 18 at that point, 18-year-old absolute superstar. He was a real big hope because a lot of their squad was players who had been there throughout this journey. You know, they'd started in 2008 and travelled through the whole time. So a lot of them were kind of reaching the end of their career. And he was the bright young star. It was just tragic for him, really, because he'd grown up watching all these other guys play. And it was his dream to play at a World Cup with them.
The national women's team also shone in 2022, travelling to Canberra in November for the Pacific Women's Four Nations Cup. There they finished second behind Australia after coming from behind in their final match to draw 1-1 with Fiji. They also took the competition by storm at the IFC Women's Nations Cup in July, beating Samoa in the third place playoff despite being ranked 8th out of 9 teams. Away from the soccer pitch, Solomon Islands was consumed for most of the year with getting ready for the 2023 Pacific Games, set to take place in Honiara. One athlete who's determined to represent his country at a home games is Edgar Richardson, the only Solomon Islander at the recent World Short Course Swimming Championships in Melbourne.
For me, like, really happy to compete in a world championship because for me, I really like the short course. It's more like technical because you need to do proper flip turns and underwater turns so that get you speed up bikes. I really like short course, so I'm really happy to be here in Australia.
The Pacific Games will be contested in November and December, and being such a marquee event for the region, they've attracted plenty of political attention. China funded construction of the main stadium in Honiara, while this year Australia's Pacific Minister Pat Conroy also announced a contribution of more than $16 million towards the cost of hosting.
Assistance to refurbish school dormitories to accommodate athletes and officials during the games, provide further elite training and gym equipment to the institute here, develop a temporary marine centre which will host open water sports during the games, and fund critical positions inside the National Hosting Authority and National Sports Commission.
It's all a big positive for Solomon's Prime Minister Manasseh Sogavare, who said in August that the Games will be the single largest unifying event in his country's history.
As a first-time hoster of this major sporting event, all our preparations and in planning underpinned by one single word, legacy. The Games is all about leaving a legacy for our young population and our future generations.
And that's the year in sport for Solomon Islands.
Thanks to Nick Fogarty with that report wrapping up the year in sports for Solomon Islands. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat here on a Wednesday morning. Thanks for joining us. And if you're listening to Solomon Islands and perhaps some of these stories that we played over the years have sparked some memories for you, please do get in touch. Is there anything that we missed in our coverage of Solomon Islands over the year that you wished Pacific Beat reported on? You can find us at pacific@abc.net.au. That's our email address. Or you can find us on all the regular social media accounts, Twitter, Facebook, and the like at ABC Pacific. And as we come into 2023, what are the stories that you would like to see, not just about Solomon Islands, but across the Pacific? Get in touch. Would you like to see us more cover a bit more of the geopolitical tensions with China's rising influence in the region? That was certainly a key topic this year. Or have you heard enough about that? Do you want to see more human interest stories or the like, more sports perhaps? Do get in touch with us at ABC Pacific. We love to hear from you. I'll be back tomorrow. I believe we're taking a special look at Papua New Guinea tomorrow, looking at their year in stories and songs. Do stick around for that one. And until then, have a lovely Wednesday.